Welcome. Yeah? Higher? Okay. So we're about to wrap up our final event for the day. And it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Paul Clark from the Department of Pharmacology and Therapeutics, who's been at McGill for many years, and whose research interest is actually quite interesting into the brain mechanisms that underlie dependence on drugs and alcohol and tobacco. And he was seminal in some of the contributions to the 1988 U.S. Surgeon General's report that finally connected smoking to nicotine addiction. So you not only have a world-class instructor in front of you, you also have a world-class researcher. And that is one of the big benefits of McGill, in that we are a Tier 1 research institution, and we happen to have our experts in the field that also work with our students in the classroom. He is also the 2012 prize winner, Principal's Prize winner for the Excellence in Teaching, so it is my pleasure to introduce Paul Clark for the afternoon to talk about what he had wished he'd known when he first started teaching.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thanks for staying around on such a beautiful day, and thank you, Adam, for a nice introduction there. And thank you to Erin and David for kindly inviting me to SkillSets. It's amazing what SkillSets has accomplished in such a short time. I think kudos to you guys. Whoops. Try that one again. The worst part of teaching is the instrumentation that goes with it. Especially when the clip falls off the holder, but never mind. We'll get there. I feel rather like one of Pavlov's dogs in its harness, you know, salivating on command. Well, maybe if I put it in my pocket, we can get going. So, this was, can you hear me at the back? Yes? Before I tell you about me, what about you? So, just generally, how many of you would call yourself a science? A lot. Arts? Music? Good for you. Divinity? Arts, we've done, what are we missing? Engineering? Agriculture? Certain segregation of engineers over there. I'm not quite sure what that's about. Okay. I don't know if you're aware, but there was a study done back in the 70s that looked at medical students, and they found a very strong correlation between distance from the lecturer and the success on the exam. People at the back do worse. But have to admit, though, it was a self-selected type of population. So, you know, it wasn't as if people were made to sit in given places, which would really tell you. Anyway, if you're at the back, I would move forward if I was you. So, this was not my title, and I thought this would be an easy thing to do because I've taught for quite a long time, about 40 years on and off. But as it turns out, I found it very hard to put together a talk on this subject. Why? Because it's a bit like saying, what would you like to have known before you learned to ride a bike or before you started riding a bike? To me, teaching is a lot of implicit knowledge. There's not very much, I think, I can tell you about teaching more than, you know, where to find the brakes, which way to sit on the saddle, and so on. But I'll do my best anyway. So, interesting. Yeah, so possibly relevant is the fact that I had quite a varied childhood, mostly living in African countries until the age of 8 or 10 or so. And this was good in the sense that there was lots of opportunities for observing nature, seeing things that a normal kid wouldn't see. It was bad because we started to run out of schools at a certain age. And nevertheless, I think that has formed me in an important way because I'm very interested now in biology. And I'm sure the fact that we had chameleons in the garden and all sorts of snakes slithering around was part of that. The roads in Africa are rather bumpy. And when I eventually got back to England to go to boarding school, the roads were very windy. And my parents used to smoke in the front of the car, and that just exacerbated my extreme motion sickness. And that formed me, too, because I think that's probably the reason why now I tend to research smoking behavior and what causes it. A major moment in my life was when my parents gave me a microscope and I started going around the local ponds, scraping around in the mud, and I won't even try this, will I? No, I won't even try it, because a rule of PowerPoint is if you have a video set up, it usually doesn't work. But it would show you the heart beating, various other things. I think it defecates at one point. It's all rather exciting for a 12-year-old to see this under the microscope. And that also formed me. And carrying on the theme of boarding school, most of the teaching I got was excellent, I would say, with exceptions, of course. But I was lucky enough to be in schools where the class size was small. So in some classes, like ancient Greek, we only had 3 or 4 people, 5 people maybe, students in the class. So we got to observe our teachers very well. And I think you can learn a lot from that. After 10 years of single-sex boarding school, off to Paris, bohemian life, punctuated with brief stints as doorman at the Bristol Hotel, and, importantly, first stint of teaching, I got a job teaching English conversation to French business students, stagiaire of about 23 years old, typically, boisterous, worldly, wanted to know what I thought of girls. I was 18 at the time. And I didn't have much to say about that. And it wasn't a very happy experience, my first teaching experience. So moving on. Then I get to go to one of these ancient universities in England where I had no opportunity to teach nor to present, amazingly enough. I mean, these days we get our undergrads to present as much as we can, and it's very important. Very good education in some ways, but not from the point of view of presentation skills. Indeed, at high school, I think I only made 1 or 2 presentations in front of a group of more than 10 people. Very inexperienced. What I did get from my university undergrad, however, was weekly seminars with 3 different professors, 2 students, 1 professor for an hour with tea and biscuits. And so you can talk about anything you want. A very good training in that respect, but it didn't really help when it came to coming here and doing classroom teaching. Moving on to PhD in London, a more real environment now. This was a graduate institute, no undergraduates. Very little opportunity for teaching until one day my supervisor says, you know what, Paul, there's a vacancy for someone to teach the lecture on antipsychotic drugs at University College London. Somebody's ill and can't teach it and they can't find anybody. Do you want to do it? I said, sure. So I get all my acetates prepared. Now, because you're too young to know what this is probably, these are acetates.
No, you're not?
Good for you. All right. So this was a previous teaching technology, overhead projector. It came after the epidioscope. Anybody? No? Okay. Acetate. And so I wrote it all out beautifully. I had the best lecture prepared, and I set off up to London, to the middle of London, on my motorbike, in the pouring rain, and then I got to University College. I feel there's a punchline coming soon. So there we are in this very ancient lecture theatre. You're at the bottom, you're looking up at everybody, and you open up your acetates and you find they're all smudged, the rain got in. So first real lesson in teaching, preparation, yes, but also you need to know the difference between these and these, permanent and water soluble. Okay, and in fact, the lecture was pretty terrible, I think. That was the impression I got. After a while, I felt with everybody looking down on me that I was some sort of... it occurred to me it was probably originally an anatomical dissection theater, you know, where they took condemned criminals, put them to death, and then rapidly dissected them in public. That's how I felt. Anyway, it can't have been totally bad because the next year they invited me back, but not to teach antipsychotic drugs. This time it was statistics. Obviously, it was just a question of who was dropping out. I was parachuted in, and I had to teach them analysis of variance. Some of you will know that this is a common statistical technique based on fairly difficult calculations, and I took it upon myself to learn, memorize by heart, all the equations and the calculations for two-way analysis of variance, and I did it without error, I think, and it was something I'm still very proud of, and it was a terrible way to teach, because I had absolutely no idea what the basis of analysis of variance was. It was only about 15 years later than I found out, actually, when I actually started teaching the subject myself. Anyway, so that was University College. Then I went off postdoc, first postdoc was at NIH in the States, and no opportunity for teaching there. And then I went to a well-known Canadian university on the West Coast for another postdoc. And this was a bit more fruitful from my point of view, because somebody said, you know what, I don't really want to teach my course on brain and behavior. It is a whole course, but we could pay you, you know, $70 or something. And so I said, all right, I'll do that. So while I was a postdoc, I had my first full course, which I taught essentially out of the textbook, 1 week ahead of the students. And God, did I wish I had, you know, there was some way of just paying $177 and getting becoming instantly good at speaking in public. But it didn't come easy. But it was really, really useful experience when I finally, after all those years of training and at an advanced age, I finally got this job at McGill. And when I came for the interview, I remember several people said to me, you know, this is a good place to come because the way things are set up, you're only going to have about 10 hours of teaching a year, no more than that. It's really good. And I was thinking, that doesn't sound very good to me. I actually like teaching. I'm starting to like it. So anyway, as the years have grown and as our major honors minor program in pharmacology took off a few years ago, the genie's really out of the bottle now. We don't have any control over it. It seems half the university wants to study pharmacology at present. So there's tons of teaching to do. The medical students require a lot of teaching too. Excuse me. So that's McGill. And so what do I teach? I teach basically three different sorts of things. I teach quite a bit of pharmacology, undergraduate science students, medical students. I also teach statistics, and this came about a few years after I arrived, and I've been doing that for about 15 years or more. And then finally, much more recently, we've developed a course on what we call now research professionalism, started as research ethics or scientific misconduct or conduct or something. Keeps changing its name. But anyway, so that's sort of my teaching portfolio, if you like. It's quite a lot of hours. It's probably the most in my department. And I wish I could trim it down, but I like doing every part of it, so it's difficult. Now, as far as telling you what I know about teaching, this is very difficult, and I don't want to be prescriptive. So I'm going to give you a few clues about how I teach, but it may not apply to you. It may not fit your personality, for example. So, you know, this is actually very hard to get book. I realize it's a rare book. I happen to have a copy. Tells young ladies in the 60s how to behave. You know, if you're in a restaurant and you drop your napkin on the floor, then your cavalier is supposed to get up and get it for you. So it teaches you how to do things. But I don't think there's such a useful guide for teaching in the same way. All right. So the first thing about teaching in big classes is you've got to figure out how you're going to use a textbook. Are you going to use a textbook? How are you going to use it? Well, I teach pharmacology as a team. So I teach at the 300 level, I teach at the 500 level. In both cases, I'm not the coordinator, I don't have much control, and we have a textbook. The thing is about textbooks is that they are, these days, often extremely good. But, on the other hand, they tell you things that you don't necessarily need to know for the course. The book on the right here is The Bible of Pharmacology, and I think it's still recommended to medical students. My copy is 2,000 pages. So part of my role, therefore, is to fence off different parts of the textbook and tell people what to read and what not to read. But to be honest, most of the exam questions are not on the textbook, and I tell the students that. I find that I've got enough to say without referring to the textbook, although I do encourage them to read the textbook to some extent, but concentrate on what I'm telling them. Okay. So I'll tell you a little bit about the way I try to teach pharmacology. And undergrad and medicine is a little different. Undergrad, these are people who might become scientists one day, and so they really need to know the basis of things, what kind of evidence we have. I have to try to evaluate the evidence for things that we believe about drugs and how they work. And in medicine, medical students are terribly overwhelmed with lots of data, and so I try to figure out what would be most important for them to know, but there's much less emphasis on how we know things. Okay, and I like this quote, you should treat as many patients as possible with the new drugs while they still have the power to heal. The same principle applies, I think, to the 50-minute lecture. This is the battle of my whole career, is trying to figure out what to do with this great big slab of time which extends long beyond the normal attention span. The tyranny of the 50-minute lecture. So the idea is, you know, try and get in as much at the beginning before people fall asleep. The vigilance decrement is our enemy. And I would say, if you want to know, if I can tell you one thing about teaching, as far as the most useful thing to know about teaching, as far as I'm concerned, is try to keep the students awake. If you can, no, seriously, if they fall asleep, they're not going to learn very much. It's been shown you don't learn much when you're asleep. You know, these you can learn Russian with a tape recorder under your pillow. Doesn't work. They've done studies on that. So you have to keep the students awake. And I use every trick I can think of to do that. And some of them are really quite unsophisticated. So let's say the one point to make is I think people get that I'm quite serious about teaching, but I try to keep the atmosphere light. So here's a guy who's smoking 800-plus cigarettes, and he's not dying. So the question is, why is he not dying? And so we could have a bit of discussion about that, and probably from the discussion would emerge the idea that maybe his nicotinic receptors, remember nicotine is a poison, plants use it as an insecticide, humans are susceptible to high doses, so maybe his nicotinic receptors have become desensitized. Or, possibly, this guy is a bit unusual from Transylvania, who knows? Maybe he has a receptor mutation. There's another possibility. Or maybe he didn't inhale. So the point is that you can use a picture to start a discussion going. And you're all still awake, most of you. So that's good. And then we can get into the more important scientific stuff. But I do it that way. I often go in obliquely to a subject. This is telling you about the effects of anesthetics on the cell membrane, and it's all very interesting. And this slide usually appears at around 12:15 in my anesthesia lecture. 12:15, what are people thinking around 12:15? Well, they're probably thinking of food, getting a bit hungry, so we introduce that, because a hungry student is an awake student. Then we have the little cartoony things that just keep the thing jogging along. So if I'm talking about smoking cessation methods to the medical students, you know, we can put in little, slightly incongruous pictures as we go along. And that sort of helps, I think, cement the information for them, we hope. Now, I use cartoons not very often because I think they often backfire. You know, we all differ in what we find funny with cartoons. But this one's quite... So when I use a cartoon, I try to make it very relevant to the topic that I'm about to discuss. How are the nicotine patches working? Not so hot. What's wrong? If you roll them up tight, they won't stay lit. Now, the point of this is that a patch... And we know that nicotine patches don't work very well for helping people give up smoking. But why? So the point is that they're not like cigarettes. You put them on the skin, the nicotine's absorbed slowly. With a cigarette, you're getting the nicotine in much faster than that. And the strong feeling in the nicotine smoking community that that's probably why the patches aren't working so well. So use humor in the service of something very direct. I try not to use random cartoons just to make people laugh. Another thing is, I have a feeling, and I have no evidence for this, but when we remember things, I think we embed it in a very rich associative network. If we actually do remember things, it's because we link it to lots of other things in our brain, not in isolation. So I try to anchor concepts and information to things that people might know about already. So some people are interested in soccer. It's not as interesting as rugby, in my opinion, but still, we'll go with it. So let's say I'm teaching the medical students about partial agonists. This is a kind of drug that stimulates receptors, but not very effectively. They could be used to control heart rate, for example, which is being measured here in a soccer spectator, comes to the game, nothing much going on initially, heart rate at around 100, so it's a bit of anticipation, one assumes, but nothing very exciting happening until the first bit of action, and there's Barthez leaping up and almost falling on somebody. And then things settle down a bit, and you see the heart rate coming down, and then there's a bit more excitement of that kind. And then we get the drug. And there's the oxaprenolol going into the system, and then you can see what happens to heart rate. Uncontrolled experiment, obviously. But I think, you know, having the images, particularly for the males in the audience, tends to cement the thing in the mind. You know, you can kind of remember that. People tend to remember that slide. Another thing is, in 50 minutes, you can cram too much information in, and it gets really boring, and people won't remember anyway. So that's great, because then I can dilute the scientific information with stories, historical things, which I think are actually quite neat to know. So, and again, you try to anchor it to something people know. So unlikely that most people in there, in U2, will have heard of Charcot, I would think, who was a great neurologist in France in the 19th century. And they certainly won't have heard of his stretching apparatus with which he treated Parkinson's patients at his hospital in Paris. But what they may know, what they may have read, the book or seen the movie, Awakening's there. So there's an anchor, something they can relate to, hopefully. Equally, antipsychotic drugs. Interesting story. Henri Laborie, he was a surgeon. He had a problem. His patients were dying on the operating table. Why? Didn't know. Maybe too much stress before the operation. Maybe release of histamines. So he sends off to a drug company. They give him chlorpromazine, which the drug company considers at the time an antihistamine. And they basically gave it to him because they thought the drug was no good as an antihistamine. It was kind of too weak. Anyway, so there's Laborie, and he discovers that the patients get calmed down. He says to his psychiatrist friends, try this on your psychotic patients. And it worked. So they won't have heard of Laborie, very unlikely, but they probably heard of Salvador Dali. And I've happened to figure out that Laborie and Salvador Dali knew each other. So there's a little thing to hook that on. Chlorpromazine, the first antipsychotic, first used in North America in Verdun, Montreal. Hans Lehmann has a pavilion named after him. This is the Douglas Hospital, what we now know as the Douglas Hospital. So, again, a little bit of familiarity helps, I think. And then everybody knows about milk, but they might remember that prolactin is the hormone that controls milk secretion, and then I tell them that dopamine inhibits that through a certain kind of receptor. And this is all in the context of antipsychotic drugs and their side effects. And so then, to sort of give them the larger picture, I introduce where the milk is coming from. And also, I throw in a slide of Monty Python. I know this is probably a bit dated now, but it's quite useful because this tells them that this is this side effect of the antipsychotic drug, which is increased milk secretion, doesn't just happen in women. It happens in men, too. So not too many words on this slide, but hopefully people remember it. People come up to me afterwards sometimes, you know, months later, and they can't get that image out of it. Anyway. Another thing is, another thing to stress is that medicine, pharmacotherapy, is a work in progress. So, you know, whereas Charles II of England had all sorts of horrible things done to him, you know, extracts of boiled puppies and pigeon dung put on his feet in order to try to make him better. You know, we've got better through the ages. Leeches are no longer, well, actually, leeches are still in use in some, they're still useful. But the point is that, you know, today's drug is going to be looked upon in the future as a pretty bad drug. Chances are, right? Very few drugs stay around very long. They get superseded. So that's a recurrent theme. And then sometimes I have to address more adult topics, and this takes a little bit more tact. And I actually introduce it with this slide because I say I hope you're not going to be offended by what I'm about to say. And this is to relate the first rational treatment for epilepsy. So the epilepsy lecture starts with the idea that many famous people were epileptics, and I get them to shout out their names as they come on the screen. Most people get Bergman there. Or rather Jeanne d'Arc. There's Richelieu, and I ask them to remember Richelieu in particular, and then we have Molière and Flaubert and Dostoevsky, who had epileptic characters in some of his novels, and we have Van Gogh, and we have Alfred Nobel. And so this is all to give people the idea that doesn't mean that if you're epileptic you're going to become famous, but it tells you that epileptics are quite common. It's quite a common disease. So that's one point. And then the Richelieu is a setup for what's coming next. So and then just to round it out, we have Lenin and Charlie Chaplin. So then we move on to 1857, where a guy called Siefking had done a very careful study of over 50 patients trying to figure out what caused their epilepsy. And he got up at this meeting in London, and he, as soon as he sat down, the chair of the meeting, Sir Charles Locock, got up and basically held the floor as chairs are not supposed to do, and started telling people his ideas about what causes epilepsy. And the first thing was that crowded teeth was obviously something that could cause epilepsy, and he knew of quite a few individuals who'd had teeth removed and had got better. Second thing was, and this was his most important point, he said, second cause of epilepsy is hysteria in women related to the menstrual cycle. And here he was speaking with great authority. You laugh, but he was speaking with great authority because he was the obstetrician to Queen Victoria, delivering, I don't know, maybe six of her children or something. And then the last thing, and this is where we get into the rational treatment for epilepsy, is onanism. He said onanism is the third. Now, what the hell is onanism, people say? So I have to take them through the Old Testament and explain that Onan was the son of Judah, and God killed Onan's brother, standard punishment for wickedness in those days, and then told Onan to procreate with his sister-in-law, which he didn't really fancy, and so he spilled his seed upon the ground, and that is onanism, right? And or what the Victorians called onanism. So then we get to the rational treatment, which is potassium bromide. Lowcock had read that this was a sexual depressant in the German literature, as it happens, and he thought, quite rationally, that if masturbation is causing epilepsy in some individuals, then if we can suppress that, then we can reduce epilepsy, which is why I asked you to remember Richelieu. There we go. So, you might ask, does the treatment work? I'll tell you later. Then, you know, we can talk about how things have changed with time again. So if I'm talking about drug addiction, I might point out that benzodrine amphetamine inhalers were available in first class on transatlantic flights back in the 30s. Then migraine. So you don't want to list on a slide the things that you want people to know. You want to ask them, so what causes migraine, anybody? And so somebody will say chocolate, you know. And after, you know, a very short time, you've got the list pretty much of the common causes of migraine. So I go very much with pictures. And that works for me, and I hope it works for the students too. Then we come to the anxiety lecture. And this is very oblique, because what I'm really trying to teach them is about beta blockers. Most of you probably know that beta blockers are a kind of anti-anxiety drug, and they're widely used by musicians, violinists, pianists, and other musicians. And so there's nothing like a practical demonstration of this. So at this point, I get out my trumpet, and I explain that I met the principal trumpet player in the McGill Symphony Orchestra down at Hurley's Irish pub the other day. And so we decided that he was going to come, or it could be a she, depends on the year. And I'm looking at my watch because this person usually doesn't arrive on time. And we're going to both play this very difficult piece, The Carnival of Venice. And one of us will have taken the beta blocker, and it's up to you to figure out who's playing better. Then you know who, and then we'll tell you who took the drug, and you'll see if the drug worked. So that's the setup. And I'm looking at the door, and no trumpet players emerging. So we start talking about the experiment. And is it a good experiment? Well, you know, it's not double blind, is it? You know who, if you took the drug or not. Yeah, that's true. What else? Can we really say that, you know, with an N of one in each group, is that enough? Somebody inevitably says, maybe they're just basically a better trumpet player than you, which is a good opportunity to look hurt. So anyway, and so it goes. And then at the end, the trumpet player, 15 years I've been doing this, and the trumpet player never arrives. And what the students don't realize is it takes an enormous amount of work and effort to trail, you know, to follow trumpet players from the music faculty, see if they go to the pub, and then start talking to them and persuade them to come to the class. Anyway, so it's a funny thing, but either the students are humoring me about this, or they really think that there's a trumpet player who's going to come. And the hope is... The hope is from this that they will remember something about beta blockers because they're so excited and keyed up and not asleep. A variant on this is if I can get a grad student to come as if to play the trumpet, and a lot of expectation, the trumpet player's arrived, and then I say, what do you want? And they say, unfortunately, trumpet player phoned, can't come. So then I ask the graduate student, well, do you know about beta blockers? What are the side effects? So get someone else to tell the lecture. It helps just variety whenever you can. So you're wondering at this point, how much do my students learn? And where do you find the balance between entertainment and education? And that's a very fine balance. I don't know. And part of it is to do with the way that we evaluate students, which I'll get to a little bit later on. Actually, you may or may not know this study that came out, I think quite recently, where there were two groups of students on different occasions, but the same teacher for both. In one case, the teacher stood upright, made eye contact, and did not read from a script. In the other, she's hunched over, she's not looking at the class, and she's reading in a very unprofessional way. And it was just for a minute on each occasion. And then they evaluated the teacher. The two classes evaluated her. Of course, this got a much better evaluation than this. And then they also tested the students to see how much knowledge they'd acquired. And maybe you're not surprised to learn that there was no difference between the groups. So, you know, there's a chance that teaching style really doesn't count for much. I tend to think, it's amazing that this hasn't been studied in depth. Correct me, anybody who knows better, maybe it has been studied. But my impression, it hasn't. But it's absolutely crucial. You know, learning is still, I think, quite a mysterious thing. And I think it sort of happens while a whole lot of other things are going on. I just feel that I'm more of a catalyst than anything else. Anyway, moving ahead. What do you do with a class that's 300 or 500, as we're going to get soon in pharmacology? How do you deal with that? You know, for me, teaching is to do with communication. And it's, of course, complete illusion, but I like to think that I have a personal relationship with people I'm teaching. Well, one answer to having 300 or more people in the class is to record the lecture. And then you find that you're there almost alone, and you can treat it as a small group. So that's one approach. But actually, often the big class rapidly gets down to 100, or in some cases, the class may only be 50 students, in which case we teach upstairs. And I like 50 students because I don't find that you need to have it as a lecture. It can be a small group. And so my trick is to get the mugshots of the students beforehand, and I memorize the names and the faces as much as I can. Short-term memory. And then when I'm in class, I say, oh, David, what do you think about this? You know, and so on. It works particularly well if by the third lecture you've figured out who are the mice in the class, the ones who always regularly come but don't say anything. Because then if you ask them, you use their name and ask them, then the look of astonishment is worth anything. So you might think it's pretty painful to have a teacher asking you direct questions, not waiting for a hand to go up, but asking direct questions. And I was painfully shy when I was a student, and I would have hated that. So the only thing I can say is that what I do is I ask and I move on very quickly if I don't get an answer. If it looks as though the person's actually come up with an answer after I've moved on, then I go back to them. But I don't dwell on one person. I try to work the room, and then people forgive you. Through all the many years of teaching evaluations, I don't think I've ever had anybody, maybe one or two, say, I really don't like that. Usually people say, I like that, or they don't say anything at all. So I think it's a question of how you do it. I think it's very valuable to get people to talk in classes for their sake, because I was the mouse. I used to just sit there. And I sure wish I'd had somebody who would have dragged me out of my shell. So in essence, then, I don't rely on the popcorn method. I don't say, does anybody want to talk about this? No. It takes too much time. We don't have time to waste. So I don't rely on the popcorn technique. Typically, I pick on people. And then in the class, it's useful to punctuate at several points and say anything you don't understand. Now, if it was a big class, people might be too shy, and they might think, oh, I'm being dumb. You know, everybody else understands. So a good method there is to say, talk to the two people next to you and see if there's anything you don't understand. Because if two or three people don't understand, then they have the courage to ask the question. So I find that very useful. Another thing is you can set up a sort of small group spontaneously by saying, all right, why is it that we have different alcohol legal limits for driving in different countries? This is a bit out of date, by the way, but anyway. the principle's the same. Why is that? Do we all metabolize alcohol to the same rate, and so forth? So I give them 2 minutes to talk to their neighbors and come up with a thing. And I find that's very engaging for the students as well. Big classes have note-taking clubs. If they do, then you really need to look at the notes, because this is a great source of misinformation. Not only do I talk absolute rubbish sometimes, and that needs to be corrected before it gets disseminated, but also the note-taking clubs are often not very well done. I'd say 3/4 of the time they're done carefully, but for some reason there's a certain proportion in almost any class where they don't even spell check. And it's really, I find it a little bit insulting. But the point of this slide is just to say, yes, we want to see, and all my colleagues do this in the undergraduate course, we want to see your notes before you disseminate them, please, and we will look at them quickly, because I think speed is the thing. Usually people are working for a deadline. So that's pharmacology. Statistics is the thing I got into much after maybe 3 or 4 years. And it came about because we used to have a short course in statistics, maybe 6 sessions, summer evenings, Tuesdays, I think. It was the same night as softball practice. You can imagine that the participation wasn't very good. Students didn't show up. We had an excellent teacher. For a while, we had Rhonda Amsell, who's a just brilliant stats teacher. And, you know, understandably, the teachers that we used to hire from outside got fed up. So in a moment of weakness, I said, well, let me try. And my only experience of teaching stats was that awful thing in London, and I'd never actually taken a class in stats. I just kind of learnt it along the way, and not very well at that. So I learnt a lot myself the first year, and I was very lucky to have Jim Handley from epidemiology, who taught half the class and really gave me the confidence to do this. But stats is great. It's called Statistics for Pharmacologists. There's very little pharmacology in it. The name is really just to keep away the riffraff. And it's a great course from my point of view, because statistics covers everything and you don't have to talk about pharmacology. The other thing is I always start by telling them I'm not a statistician, which is true. Never had a course in stats. This is good. Why? Lowers expectations, also promotes self-directed learning. You've all heard that that's a good thing, right? So there are various ways you can teach stats. You can do it in a boring way or try to make it interesting. I try to make it interesting by bringing in real-world examples. So here, for example, if I'm trying to tell them what a histogram is, in case they've forgotten, then I go with something like this, where you rapidly discover that your password is one of the top 10 in all the internet, worrying. At the beginning of the stats course, I say to the students, these are first-year graduate students, it's a mandatory course, it's usually about 15 in the class, I give them a questionnaire, do you know what a t-test is, do you know what ANOVA is, do you know what the mean is, median, blah, blah, blah. And pretty much most of those questions they're going to say, don't know, don't know, don't know. And my last question is always, have you ever done a stats course before? And they always have. And that's not to say that the stats courses they take at the undergraduate level are bad, they're probably good, but you cannot really retain stats, I think, unless you actually have data to chew on. So that's why I have the great advantage in having them in their first year when they're about to produce data. Typically in our department, a graduate student in their first year will be producing data within 4 or 5 years. Okay, that was a joke. Right, and likewise, if you want to introduce what is a scatter plot? You can use interesting examples, you know, relating GDP to happiness or whatever you like. There's so many examples you can use. You can show them that, perhaps contrary to expectations, plasma testosterone levels are comparable in firemen and university professors. Or you could get a bit more serious and you could look at post-mortem blood levels in people who've been executed by different states in the US. You may know that the lethal injection is actually 3 different drugs. One first to thiopental, for example, it's a general anesthetic, so you lose consciousness. Then they paralyze your muscles with a second drug. Then they give potassium chloride, which stops the heart, essentially induces a heart attack. Potassium chloride injection is extraordinarily painful. That's why you have the anesthetic first. This is a paper in Lancet which shows that actually in a good proportion of subjects, anesthetic levels of drug were not obtained. So they were most probably conscious. So that's pretty shocking. It also helps to introduce the idea of median and scatterplot. Now, you know, a lot of students take drugs as well as studying them, so you can... box plots are fairly dull, but you can try to enliven it with this study where they sifted through the sewage in major cities and looked for levels of cocaine and ecstasy. And ecstasy tends to peak on a Sunday, which might surprise you, but it might be telling you something about the transit time of ecstasy through the GI tract. Confidence intervals, well, I don't know if you realize this, but Hawkeye, Wimbledon, etc., we take it as a yes or no answer from Hawkeye, but actually there's a confidence interval. They're using mathematical modeling to try to figure out the probability of where the ball is, essentially. So that's a nice way into confidence intervals. Then if you want to talk about binomial tests, the standard way is coin flipping. I've just flipped my coin 10 times and it came down heads 8 times. How unlikely is that? Standard but boring. So you could introduce this study, I think it's from the University of Victoria, where they had a robotic dog which wagged its tail to the left or the right, and other dogs approached, and you watched the behavior of the dog approaching. And it turns out dogs react differently depending on whether your tail is wagging to the left or the right. Did you spot the robotic dog in the picture? It's the one in the front. Or, if you don't like that, you can introduce the same idea, binomial test, you can explain it in a different way. Normally we think of dogs smelling humans, but this is where humans were smelling dog odors. Turns out you can reliably figure out the smell of your own dog, discriminate from other dogs. It's all, again, to make the statistical point that the binomial test is used for a certain kind of data. All right. Now, things have moved on since I was teaching my brief appearance at University College teaching stats. We don't do things the same way, just as in the McIntyre cafeteria. We don't have ashtrays on the tables, nor do we have a separate lunchroom for professors. I don't know why not, but that's the way it is. So there's very little calculation involved in stats. It's much more concepts. So, for example, with correlation, we could ask when it's windy, the branches are going all over the place, right? So are you one of... some people in the world believe that the wind is caused by branches moving. So we get into cause and effect. Likewise, the more firemen there are at a fire, the larger the fire is likely to be. Did you know that? You should never call the fire brigade. One rather intriguing correlation, which we sometimes discuss, is this one. Different states in the U.S., the percentage of place names that have some Christian name or concept in them against the proportion of obese people in that particular. So there's a lot we can talk about correlations. Another one, and this is quite a serious one. This came out in the New England Journal of Medicine, you may have heard of recently. They took different countries and they figured out the per capita chocolate consumption and the proportion of the population that received Nobel Prizes. And what does this mean? Hard to know, but you'll notice that Sweden is an outlier and you know where the Nobel Prize... Right. So it was a serious paper, and I think it makes a serious point, and I rather like the bit in the discussion where it says one cannot quite escape the notion that either the Nobel Committee in Stockholm has some inherent patriotic bias when assessing the candidates for these awards, or perhaps that the Swedes are particularly sensitive to chocolate. And even minuscule amounts greatly enhance their cognition. Okay. So another thing I do in the stats class is I try to train students to try to help them think on their feet. It's a bit patronizing, I think, to say I try to make them think on their feet. They probably know how to think on their feet, but they go along with it anyway. So I give them surprise acetates and that sort of thing printed. I have the PowerPoint ready for them. They get 5 minutes or so, and then they have to get up and they have to present. It'll be one single page, and I call these surprise examples. So they'll get some study. You know, that's the information they got. Have a look at that for a sec. Yes, that is George Clooney. So the point of this is what do you do with outliers? And so that's a bit in red, and that's what they have to present. So that would be one example. Here's another one. Hormonal changes when falling in love. And the question is, are the statistical tests optimal? So, you know, you have to figure it out. You've only got a short time to do it. Hopefully it makes people sharp. Here's another one. Rats exposed to Mozart in early life subsequently prefer Mozart to Jean. Is the analysis appropriate? This is the beauty of stats. There's so much weird stuff in the literature that you can use. All right, so that was stats. Now I want to tell you about evaluations. When you're any teacher, and I'm sure a lot of you have TA'd already and been evaluated, so can say a few things about this. The first thing is we try to get as many people to evaluate the course as possible, and this is always a struggle. And yet, if we don't do that, we don't get a representative sample. And arguably, even if there were 70% people who evaluated the course, we might be missing an important 30%. So how do we do that? Well, we keep reminding them, which probably doesn't do much good, or we use jokes. So this is the one I like. One night with Venus, a lifetime with Mercury. Used to be a common saying. Do you know what it refers to? Venus, god of love. So one night with Venus, and then the rest of your life, you're going to have to take Mercury to try to cure the syphilis. Yeah? Well, it works. Come on. Got a response. Or this one. This one I like. I don't know where I got this from. If I had 1 hour to live, I'd spend it in this class because it feels like an eternity. Now, we used to, back in the old days when we had paper evaluations, we used to read everybody's evaluation. It was really hilarious. You know, you always hope that some student would say, I think Dr. So-and-so needs a personality change. I remember that happened once. Not to me, thank God. So there's always going to be 1% or so of sociopaths in the student body, and they usually fill out the evaluation. So, you know, you always have to discount one or two just because, well, it's best not to take it too seriously. The difficulty with these evaluations is to know what they mean and to get honest evaluations. I so often hear corridor talk about people quite justifiably probably complaining about teachers, individual teachers. Oh, he didn't show up on time, his handouts weren't ready, he dumped 40 pages on us and expected us to remember. And then it doesn't come out in the evaluations. Why? I don't know. People seem to be very forgiving. So it's very hard to get an honest appraisal. And if you become professors, most of you, well, hopefully a lot of you will, how are you going to do that? Your colleagues are not going to show up and hear you talk. So you pretty much have to rely on students. I've been very lucky. Barbara Hales, who coordinates one of the courses, sat in on all my classes initially and gave me good feedback. That was really great, but that's unusual. Doesn't happen much these days. We used to have a chair who everybody feared, who used to come and sit in on every medical lecture and then give lots of criticism. Doesn't happen. So as Oscar Wilde said, a good friend is one who stabs you in the front. It's hard to find friends like that in academia. Now, as far as knowing whether you've done a good job would not be getting a good evaluation necessarily. A good job would be imparting something useful to the students. And how do we test for that? Well, the trouble is, I think we're at the mercy of these MCQs, multiple choice questions, which obviously test for something, test for knowledge. But I have to admit, if 300 people are taking pharmacology this year, we're not all of them are going to become pharmacologists, and not all of them need to know that clonidine is an alpha-2 receptor agonist. I hardly need to know that. So I try to be very careful in the kind of limit the amount of factual knowledge I give. I don't like multiple choice questions. If I had multiple, because they encourage this kind of stuffing, at least the geese retain what they're given. You know, but students kind of dump it out on the exam and then, you know. So my ideal MCQ would look a bit like that, but it would take about 10 hours to do the exam. This requires logical thinking as well as knowledge, and that one might take a bit longer even. This actually was a short answer question, and this was the last time I did it. I think there were 100 students in the class. It took too long to think, because there's two problems. There are so many scripts to mark. I don't have the time to do that. We don't have the TAs to do it either. And it's absolute torture because half the students in the class don't know how to write English. I'm sorry to say this, but a lot of undergrad science students think it's okay to write arrows and their own personal abbreviations. It's really like being on the rack. Right. Very briefly, and wrapping up now, mentoring grad students. This is a very personal thing, and everybody does it differently, and I do it very much like how I was trained, for better or for worse. A lot has to do with finding the balance between nagging and giving freedom to the student. I strongly recommend, if you're interested, to read Nature's Guide for Mentors. Tells you how you can be more than a supervisor, but also a mentor. If anybody didn't get it, it's Nature 447, page 791. Very well worth reading that. The other thing I think, another contribution I can make to graduate students, in fact any student, is this awful word like, which seems to have taken over the language to an alarming extent. It's a horrible word, especially that K at the end. And anybody who thinks they're going to go on into a professional career needs to get this under conscious control. And I think one of my main contributions as a teacher is discouraging students from using the word like in mid-sentence. It's pure laziness. And I have a horrible feeling that it's going to sweep the world, and there might be just a few islands on the northwest coast of Scotland that will be still saying and ah rather than like. Skill sets, wonderful thing. In parallel, we were doing something, that's Bernard Robert, my colleague, and I. We decided to start talking about ethics, and so we set up some workshops for that. Now we have about 7 workshops, and those are the kinds of topics that we deal with, the things that you don't get in normal classes. And we like it because we give it to our grad students, maybe 10 to 15 or 20 in a given year. We kind of know them personally, and we think that helps to make it better. But that's what we do. But skill sets is definitely highly commendable. And I'll just finish with this. I don't know how many of you know Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. Dudley Moore you probably know from movies, no? Okay, this was a great comedy duo some years ago. And so there's Dudley Moore on the left, and he's the interviewer. Peter Cook on the right. Peter Cook is an eccentric ex-RAF colonel, wing commander, who has started a pub, and all they serve is frog and peach dishes made of frog and peach. So Dudley Moore says, and it's a terrible disaster, and Dudley Moore says, do you think you've learned from your mistakes? Peter Cook says, oh, yes, indeed, certainly I've learned from my mistakes. In fact, I think I could repeat them all absolutely perfectly. So that's me in teaching. If there's any time left, and if there are questions, please fire away. Thank you. Small campus.
Well, smaller, I suppose, but you didn't teach that many students, and then suddenly you were teaching in McGill, which had a number of...
Yeah, well, I had the transition. I was very lucky, because I had the transition. A lot of people don't get this. A lot of people go straight into their research career, right, as assistant prof, with very little, some TAing, but I had the opportunity as a postdoc at UBC to teach that whole course. So it didn't count towards tenure, so I could, if I did badly, it didn't matter. And then I transferred here, and I was already used to the atmosphere of a class, the strangeness of talking to people who don't talk back to you. You know, that's something, it's all to do with experience. I used to get terribly nervous teaching, I forgot to mention that. And it's so much to do with just getting used to people looking at you and not saying anything. The lecture format is just so unnatural. Does that answer your question?
That is
question. Yeah. At the back.
The whole issue of not putting too much information on the slide or in the lecture, but you still have this huge volume that they're going to be accountable for. Can you say, this stuff needs to be from the textbook, it's not in the lecture, or how do you manage
that? Yes. So I have a lot of information, apparently, in my lectures. And how do the students know what they really have to know and what they can just take as interest only? Is that your question, really?
No, if you're trying to not jam-pack
yes.
information into your lecture and your slides, does that mean that you can say that you're accountable for all this other information in the text that I didn't cover in class?
Yeah, okay. So sometimes I say to them, this topic I haven't had time to cover. I'm not going to cover this topic, therefore read the textbook. You're accountable for that. But most of the time I tell them, you know, spend 80% of your time on the material that I'm going to present in my lecture, 20% reading the textbook, and by the way, pay particular attention to these pages. That's how I do it. I also tell them that I give a lot of history, which most of the students seem to like, but I tell them that it's just interest and it's not going to appear on the exam. And so people say, you know, a typical question is before the final exam, all this history you've told us, is it important? And so I tell them, yes, it is important, but it's not going to be on the exam. Yeah. But I have to say, perhaps it didn't come out, but in the pharmacology undergrad courses, a lot of what I talk about is experiments. They found this, it could have meant this, it could have meant this, then they did that. These are the interpretations. So I try to get away from the purely factual memorization and more into the what do we do with this knowledge. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I don't like multiple choice. I introduced small answer, you know, half-page things. But when the class size got too big and when I saw after a few years I just couldn't face this poor scientific writing, that was it. It was too depressing, honestly. And it's not just people with foreign names. It's... Anyway. So I'll tell you what I think is a good way to teach. Good for the students, but becoming unpractical. In our 500-level pharmacology, general pharmacology course, we have two sessions where we have small groups. So the class of 95 is split into about 10 groups of 9.5. And so I have to get hold of 10 small group leaders, which will be profs and grad students, and I give them a topic. So last time it was, to what extent is tobacco withdrawal nicotine withdrawal? To what extent is nicotine withdrawal responsible for the symptoms of tobacco withdrawal? So I tell the students, you three are going to be on the four team arguing on one side of the argument. You are going to oppose them, and then there are going to be 3.5 judges rounding out the group. And so they go at it for 2 hours. And these small groups tend to be very popular. Students put a lot of work into it. And at the end, they're evaluated by the small group leader. And so there's no written exam. But it's testing for something different from exams, I think. The problem with that is that if you have 10 small group teachers, you get, then I graph it and I do a bit of stats, and almost inevitably we get significant differences between the groups, which shouldn't happen by chance. So I have to tweak I have to get to know the small group leaders if I can through the years, and I know that so-and-so is more generous than so-and-so, and I have to even up the marks to a large extent. Between group, across groups.
And this is the only thing that you do for evaluation. That's the only thing they get the grade for.
No, it's not the only thing they get the grade for. There's the course is 13 weeks. The small groups are just 4 hours. But it's a lot of work they put in to be there for the 4 hours. So they have a midterm, they have a final, which is almost all multiple choice, as far as I know. Still, I'm not the coordinator. Yeah.
We have time for one more.
I wonder, Professor, to what extent there's perhaps a balance to be struck of this very eclectic, interesting lecture style, but I guess I'd be a little nervous if I didn't have the authority and experience that you have to adopt that style. Do you think there's obviously a balance to be struck, but Is there caution there?
I'm sure there is a caution there, yes. When I started out, I was incredibly scared of forgetting my material, making a fool of myself. It's a great motivator for trying to improve, of course. But as the years go by, I get surer and surer of the material. And because there's real content in the class, I just gave you the fluff today, basically, the stuff that will keep you awake, hopefully. Kept you awake. But there's enough solid science that I transmit that I think I've got their attention, and so they realize that it's not all fluff, which might be sort of... Is that your preoccupation?
Well, I assume that if you're speaking, they're going to assume it's not all fluff to begin with. I don't know if they have the same assumption if I'm speaking.
I'm sure they would.
I'm sure they would. I don't know. I don't know what to say. Yeah. Yeah, you probably should be more conservative in the early years. Probably so. But I find students seem to have a built-in respect if you stand in front of a class somehow. It's surprising.
I think that's all the time we have. I know there's a lot more questions. I'm sure Dr. Clark will be around for a few minutes if you wish to come and swamp him, as I'm sure most of his undergraduate students do. There are a couple of very important things I need to tell you just before you leave, and I'm just consulting my list here. One is you have your cards. Please drop the cards into the box at the entrance. If you wish to ensure that you get the credit for coming, you'll see Heather has them right there. Those are very important on the way out. Pete, please fill out the online feedback. You're going to get that as an email from all of us at part of the skill sets team. Also, make sure David sends the IB, the skill sets bulletin. And in that bulletin are two major events that are coming up, the AgSim training in January and the Academic Integrity Day. So keep an eye out for that. Always read that email. That's absolutely critically important. If you have a clicker, leave it at the front. And a special thanks to a couple of people I just want to make sure are acknowledged. One is Aaron, Sophia, Holly, Catlin, and Heather. They're really the core skill sets team that have put this whole thing together, and we are all standing upon their shoulders and hard work. I'd also like to thank David Sincox. You can wave over there. Everybody knows him on campus, but he is really the backbone of the skill sets team as well. And I want to leave you with one thought, and this is one thought to take away for the day. Great teachers are made. They are not born. And this day is one of the critical parts that help you along your journey as you further your professional development, think about the teaching that you're going to be doing in your career. So I hope that this is just the beginning, that you'll get into the learning and research that is out there. You'll take some of the interesting things that Dr. Clark talked about today, especially when it relates to student engagement and the critical importance it is to keep your students engaged, not only with the topic, but with you as well as an instructor. And I wish you the best of luck and a great afternoon, because it is a very nice day, so I don't want to stand in your way, so enjoy the day.
I'm sorry, I went wrong.